WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ethnic and religious fighting are dividing countries around the world. My guest Amitav Ghosh is a world traveler who now finds religious fighting at home in his country, India. There, Hindu fundamentalists have been attacking Muslims and mosques. These Hindus would like to see India have a religious government. Ghosh is of Hindu descent, but describes himself as an agnostic. He was born in Calcutta in 1956 and studied in New Delhi, Oxford, and Alexandria. He was trained as a cultural anthropologist. In 1980, as part of his research, he lived in two Egyptian villages, 2 hours from Alexandria. His new book, In an Antique Land, is about his time in Egypt. He returned to these villages in 1988 and found dramatic changes. Some of them reflected the growing influence of Islamic fundamentalism, but most of the changes were tied to the economy.
The main thing that changed is, after I left, the Iran-Iraq war started, what you might call the first Gulf War. And that led to a huge migration of migrant workers from Egypt to Iraq. In fact, when I went back in 1988, all the young people I knew were away in Iraq, working in Iraq.
They were taking the jobs of men who were fighting in the Iran-Iraq war.
Exactly, yes. They were working on, the Iraqis who were on the front. Exactly. And this had completely revolutionized the village because they sent back these huge sums of money. And, when I went back in 1988, the standards of living in the village were really revolutionized. The poorest families had washing machines and refrigerators, and everybody was building a new house. And it was extraordinary. It was really like, I really cannot believe that any place could change so much in 8 years.
And you think that was mostly because of the money that was sent back from the younger men who had left for jobs in other countries?
It was entirely that. Mm-hmm. It was entirely that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how was the village changed by fundamentalism?
That was a much more sort of gradual process, I remember noticing that even when I was, when I was first in the village, that the people who were most sort of religiously oriented were invariably the school children who were about 13, between 13 and 18. They were very religiously motivated. And as they got older, they got, they became more and more influential in the village. And when I went back in 1988, there was... it wasn't anything very dramatic, but there was certainly a sense that, people were much more sort of religiously motivated than they had been in the past. Though even in the past, in this village, for example, people took I'm really now talking about ordinary peasants. They took a very keen interest in developments in Afghanistan, for example. They would contribute the money towards the cause of the Afghan rebels. And that meant a lot to them, for very poor peasants to contribute a few piastres. It does mean a lot.
You had a friend who had grown a beard, and his parents requested that he shave it because they said it was no longer safe to look like a Muslim, even though it was a Muslim country.
I was very struck by that, actually, because, he didn't belong to any organization, and I don't think that he was a part of, of any kind of fundamentalist organization as such. But yes, he did, when he went to college, he went away to college in a town in the Delta, and he, got involved in, he just became sort of more interested in religion, and he grew a beard and, and so on and so forth. But when he got back to the village, his mother was very worried and said, his whole family was very worried and said, no, you're going to get into trouble with the government, so you better shave your beard off. And in the end, they made him shave his beard off. And I think it's quite a telling thing, really, because it is unfortunately the case, I think, often that, there's a very fine line between, the maintenance of peace, of law and order, and repression. And I think that, a lot of people like him probably felt very resentful that they couldn't just practice what they wanted to practice.
It's interesting to me that your country, India, and the country that you write about in your new book, Egypt, are both really torn apart now by religious violence.
That's absolutely true, yes. it's really very sad. And, you know, one of the unfortunate things that you see is the ways in which there are such close parallelisms, you know.
What are they?
Well, the parallelisms are not really in the religious aspect of it as, how shall I say, within the functioning of the state, so to speak, you know. Because, the Egyptian state was in some ways quite like the Indian, you know. There was sort of basic belief in a certain kind of secularism, most of all in sort of political processes and so on. And, you know, from the Nasserite period onwards, there's been a considerable hostility between the Egyptian state and Islamic groups. And the same has been true in India, you know, since the inception of the Indian state. There's been a certain sort of, you know, many Hindu fundamentalist parties have been banned and so on. I think, unfortunately, we see ourselves in a situation now where states like the Indian state and the Egyptian state are really in a no-win situation. I mean, you know, either they have to repress these movements, and that can only encourage their growth. Or, I mean, what do they do? You know, it's a really unenviable situation.
You were recently back to India. Where did you stay when you returned?
In my hometown, Calcutta, which is where I live, really.
Was Calcutta under curfew when you were there?
No, it had just there had been curfew until a few days before I got back, but there wasn't when I was there.
How deeply affected by the religious upheaval in India was your family? How close had it hit?
You know, it. Nothing had happened really very close by, nothing really close to our house. But most of all, you know, what people are hit by is the kind of is the fear on the one hand that something really terrible is going to happen in the next day. That's one of the things that these situations build up. You know, there's a sort of atmosphere of terror, of fear, and of you know, the possibility of ever greater violence. So people are literally terrified, and you know, I'm talking here about my parents, who are, you know, older people, and it's very frightening for them. The other thing is, of course, that, you know, they're just locked in the house. I mean, they can't step out of the house. They get about an hour every day to go and do their shopping. They're older people now, so it's you know, it's harder for them to do that, and it is very frightening. At the same time, you know, I'm very glad that they had the curfew, because in fact, what happened in Calcutta was that there was some trouble initially after the mosque was demolished in Ayodhya. And then, the government sort of had this curfew. And then they lifted the curfew for a day. And that was when a really sort of severe set of disturbances broke out. So, and then they had the curfew again. So, you know, it really was a very tense situation.
A lot of the tension in India now is friction between Hindu fundamentalists who would like to see the state of India become a religious state,
yes,
and those who would like to see it remain a secular state.
Yes.
The term Hindu fundamentalist was a new concept to me. I was wondering if you think of that as a new phenomenon or not.
It is substantially a new phenomenon in the sense that, you know, in the sense of it having the kind of widespread popular appeal that it does appear to have now. But, you know, Hindu fundamentalism is really a contradiction in terms in many ways. I mean, you know, Hinduism doesn't really have one book. It has this incredible multiplicity of traditions. It has, you know, really sharp internal differences between castes and so on. But there's been a movement since the late 19th century to, ironically, to reform Hinduism as such. And, you know, a lot of these have taken their clues, you know, taken as their models, Christianity and Islam even. There's a sort of emphasis on congregationalism, you know. Now, Hinduism is really not a sort of congregationalist religion as such, but here there's a sort of tremendous emphasis upon congregationalism, upon large groups of people getting together to pray together and so on. There's that for one. Then there's a sort of tremendous emphasis on conversion. Now, Hinduism, as most people know it, is not a religion that you can really be converted to as such. I mean, it's never been a sort of proselytizing religion. Even images of individual gods, you know, you see them change, and you see them sort of turning from being benevolent household gods into becoming these armed figures, you know, bearing, arms which have blood dripping off them and so on. The imagery is really terrifying.
My guest is Amitav Ghosh. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Amitav Ghosh, author of the new book, In an Antique Land. Muslim mosques and Muslim people have been under attack in parts of India. Did you grow up with Muslim friends? And I'm wondering if you've kept up with what it's been like for them recently.
You know, I think it's been really very, I mean, a lot of my friends, I've always had many Muslim friends. And, you know, when I grew up, there was really never a sense of a kind of distinction ever. And I'm happy to say that, you know, there still isn't for me. You know, it was very distressing to find out about the kinds of terror that they've been living under, you know, for the last couple of months. A lot of Muslim friends I know now are really frightened of taking the train. They won't go anywhere on the train anymore. They'll just go along certain sorts of routes because, you know, there were a lot of killings on the trains and things. But I would like to say here, Laura, that, you know, to me, one of the most disturbing aspects of, you know, what's happened in India over the last couple of months is that, you know, it seems to be something that's happening at a very local level. But in fact, it's very integrally a part of global politics. And you see this all the time inside India, that a lot of the people who are attacking Muslims, a lot of the Hindu fundamentalist rhetoric takes its cue from what it sees to be a sanctioned attitudes in the West now. You know, when we last spoke, we were talking about the Gulf War, and I was telling you then that, you know, one of the things that really worried me is the ways in which Islam is now increasingly demonized, in, you know, in the West, in the U.S., I mean, where these incredibly negative images of Muslims are presented. And it's really frightening the ways in which, you know, a lot of people within India and I'm sure in many other places take these images and appropriate them for their own use. You know, let me give you an example, you know, which I heard very recently in Delhi. I heard about this young Muslim student who'd, you know, this was while there was curfew in Old Delhi. He was walking some female relatives home, and he got caught out after the curfew hour. So he was taken to the police station there, and you know, nothing was actually done to him. But he saw some other people there, also Muslims, being actually beaten. And some of the people who were doing the beating were berating them and saying, "This is what is happening in Yugoslavia. This is what is happening to Muslims in this is what happened to Muslims during the Gulf War. This is what is happening in Somalia." So you know, they were citing these as precedents for what they were doing. You know, it's really impossible today to segregate the degrees to which the world is globalized. Incidents that happen across the world really set the pattern immediately in other places. And I really do think that, you know, the world at large bears a large part of the responsibility for what's happening in India at the moment. I mean, the fact that so many Muslims have been attacked in Germany, things like that, you know.
You write in your book that as an Indian, you've become terrified of symbols. Can you explain that?
Yes. You know, one of the sort of strange things about what's happened in India, especially, I would say, is that so much of the sort of political struggle now takes place around symbols, you know. I mean, for example, the 16th century mosque. You know, which was a very small, very unimportant mosque. It was, or I should really call it a disputed structure, because, you know, it's that's the only sort of permissible way to refer to it anymore. But this small building, you know, it suddenly became a symbol for so many kinds of historical grievances, for so many sorts of political aspirations, and you know, it's. You see the same phenomenon taking place in so many other places, that, you know, the battles become centered around particular symbols. You know, particular symbols begin to define divisions, begin to define boundaries and territories, and, you know, the supremacy of one group or the lack of supremacy of another, or the and so on and so forth.
Do you have friends who have become fundamentalists? And who have very much surprised you in this change?
Yes, yes, I have. I mean, they were not close friends, but there were certainly people I knew who I've grown up with, and who today are very, very articulate spokesmen of fundamentalism.
And of violence?
No. None of them. So none of them. I mean, they try and sort of divorce the questions of fundamentalism and violence. See, you know what their position is. I mean, what they say is that this is just another step in nationalism. You know, they say that, you know, the nation state, as we know it in India, isn't working like it is. The fault is that, you know, we're not nationalist enough. We must be more nationalist. And the only way we can be more nationalist is by reasserting a sort of a Hindu identity or whatever. And, you know, they seem to believe this. They're extremely articulate, often in stating it. And I'm really talking about people, you know, who were once very far to the left. And who now are, predictably, I suppose, very far to the right. You know, that this begs a million questions, you know, they never seem to take into account. I mean, the fact that, you know, what is this tradition you're talking about? You know, has it ever been a single tradition? Can you really hope to build a future upon, you know, reviving aspects of tradition? You know, these questions just go begging.
When you look at the fighting in your country...
Yeah.
And you ask yourself, what is this really about?
Yeah.
What do you answer?
You know, it's very puzzling. I mean, it's really puzzling because I'm increasingly it's perfectly clear that it has nothing to do with with religion. I mean, fundamentally, I don't think that the people who promote this thing that it has anything to do with religion. One part of it, I think, has to do with a sense of historical grievance, you know, that sort of that a lot of people have, and that they're increasingly venting in one way or another. But you know, most of all, I think what's really happened is that, and I think this is true of several countries. You know, in the 50s and 60s, the non-aligned movement was led by Tito, Nehru, and Nasser, representing Yugoslavia, Egypt, and India. And it's a sad irony that, you know, it's in precisely in these places that you see these, that you see the problems now representing themselves at their worst. And I think what has really happened is that, you know, countries like Egypt, India, and Yugoslavia promised something. They were built upon a certain dream, I think upon a very valuable kind of dream, you know, dreams of coexistence, dreams of equality, of a certain kind of providing for people as best they could. But, you know, like so many sort of dreams of the 20th century, they just weren't able to deliver. And I think a large part of the problems that we see over here have to do with just failed expectations and frustration.
Amitav Ghosh is the author of In an Antique Land.